Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for July 27th, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. And later this half hour, Todd Gleason will have energy analysis with Dan O'Brien of Kansas State Extension. Also, we'll look at crop progress in some of the key Corn Belt states, and we'll get the latest on agricultural weather. And in the second part of the show, the farming world, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with Mike Score of Hans Farms in Detroit, Michigan. It's all on the Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Here's how prices settled on this Tuesday afternoon in Kansas City. September wheat, 6.15 up 3. December, 6.32 up 2 and 3 quarters. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 5.95 up 5 and a half. December, 6.27 up 6. September corn, 3.62 and 3 quarters, down 1 and a quarter. December, 3.77 down 1. March, 3.90 and a half, down 1 and a quarter. July, 4.06 and a half, down 2 and a half. September soybeans, 9.73 down 1 and 3 quarters. November, 9.65 and a half, down a half. January, 9.74 and a half, unchanged. March, 9.79 and a half, unchanged. August soybean meal, 294.50 up 130. August soybean oil, 38.56 down 24. August live cattle, 92.65 unchanged. October, 93.92 and a half up 15. August feeders, 114.90 down 5. August lean hogs, 82.22 and a half up 22 and a half. October, 76.22 and a half up 75 on the day. And those are today's settlements in Chicago and Kansas City. The time now is coming up on 2:09 Central Time.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says a cool front penetrating the region tonight into Thursday will increase shower and thunderstorm activity. Rain amounts will mostly be under 0.5 inch, with a few local totals over 1 inch. Cooler and less humid conditions will occur briefly late this week, but warming during the weekend will bring another opportunity for showers. Next week's weather will be warmer with a more restricted precipitation pattern. Pockets of net drying are anticipated in portions of the Midwest over the coming week, but no area will be critically dry. Temperatures will be in the 80s and lower 90s often over the coming week.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Well, good afternoon, Dave.
Looks like wheat was the winner of the market today.
You know, that's very true, Dave, and it is the leader. It has been the leader of this last little push as we've come along the way. You know, we've seen like a 28% increase in wheat, or 27% increase in the price of wheat in the month of July here. And that, of course, coming out of the bad and disappointing weather in Russia and Kazakhstan and other parts of Eastern Europe, where they're, you know, we're seeing a shrinking wheat crop every day. And, of course, that's the area that's been very influential in selling most of the wheat to the world over the last year and a half.
The interesting thing about the wheat market is not only the fundamental news, but the technicals that go along with it. And we're kind of keeping a close eye to see if we can get above the 6-10 September basis. If you can do that, you might rally quite a ways and maybe drag corn along with it.
Very true. As far as the technical picture goes, Dave, you know, the harvest seems to be, you know, coming along, and not we don't know what they're really going to do, but it seems like we're shrinking the Russian grain harvest daily, or at least not every other day. And we've seen some tremendous increases in open interest in the wheat and also fund short covering and investment money pouring in to do that. So that's doing good. The thing that might hold that back from happening is that the cash market in the U.S. has seemed a little toppy, and we're widening the difference between the cash wheat in Kansas and the actual board price in Kansas here now, because the cash wheat isn't selling at some of the higher levels they're going into, or we're not finding export business because Russia is still undercutting us as far as the international trade on wheat for right now.
That's a real scratcher. I know that SovEcon put out the word today. I think they're trying to soften the blow just in case the crop really is bad. They suggested that it might eventually be below 70 million metric tons.
That's very true. And they also, when they asked if they're going to put a restriction on exports, they defer the question and don't answer it. And we feel that they will hold out for a while yet before they do answer that question, and no restrictions will be put on it, probably until 2011.
Let's turn our attention to corn, which had it going for a while today, but it gave up its gains in a disappointing way, it seemed to me.
When crude oil fell out of bed and went down over a dollar, and the dollar went positive on the day, is when the corn decided that it basically didn't need to do much. You know, we ended up closing down, you know, about a penny here today, and that was basically because of the weakness in the outside markets. Otherwise, you know, we've got along the way until we get to the government report and get some acreage figured out or how much is lost to drowned out areas. You know, the crop conditions report come in the same as last week, but with a little added to it because we went 2% up in the excellent column, and also the same in beans. And we are seeing no threatening weather as of this time other than the Russian weather as we look at and some of the flooding in China. We're also hearing the news along the way that maybe that some of the Chinese are not happy with the quality of the corn that is being offloaded from the U.S. in their first shipments of GMO, and you're going to have a number of people over there that would be wanting to talk about some quality problems because they are very hesitant about using the GMO corn.
Since about the end of July, June, corn has traded in a range from about 376.5 to 410. When we were at the top of that range at 410, we were saying, gee, if we could just get through there on a couple of settlements, we might see prices really push hard up into the 440 to 449 area, which would be where we had that fall off from the January crop production report. But this 376.5 area, also crucial. If we can't hold that, if you look at how we got there, there's not a lot between there and 342.
That is very much the technical support level here. We did manage to close slightly above that at 77 today. You know, it's going to take a close below 75, maybe below 74, to really feel like we've pushed through that, Dave, but we're awfully darn close to that. We do feel that there's a good chance we'll see some sideways trade between now and the report on the 12th. So, you know, but it is imperative that we hold at this area. I do know that there's a lot of people hoping to secure some feed needs down in that 350-something level.
So if someone had to ask you, is it going to go above 410 or make the break lower first, what would you think?
I think unless we see some real weather changes or something else that we don't see in the market, we're probably going to hold in here until the report, Dave. I don't see us approaching back to the $4 here without some sort of stimulus, and I also don't see us poking down to the 350 until we see some sort of stimulus.
Turn your attention to the soybeans. What was the impetus there today?
Well, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about some possibilities. The first House draft has added back in some subsidies as for the soy diesel, for the soy blending. We continue to see strength in the soy oil market along the way, and I think that's, you know, we saw a sell-off today, but, I mean, there's still the talk that there's some strength in the that part of the market. But when the crude oil fell off, the gasoline, everything that way, that, of course, knocked the crude and took some of the oomph out of that market. Now, also, you know, we still got plenty of time to change what the beans make compared to the corn. You know, to the middle of August now, we're in pretty good shape at the degree or the stage that our corn is at. We've still got, you know, at least three weeks after that to where our forecast is going out to be a little bit. So that held us from selling off too much with the oil going down. But our large push-up has been from the advantage in the oil market, the bean oil and the oil market itself, Dave.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
All right. Talk to you later.
You too. That's Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities, and he is in New Market, Indiana. Yesterday afternoon, after the closing bell, NASS released its latest crop conditions report for the week ending July 25th. Here are how the numbers look for corn. 52% of the crop is silking versus 65% last week, and the five-year rolling average of 70%. 7% of the crop is in dough stage versus 8% last week, and the five-year rolling average of 13%. Corn conditions, 2% is rated very poor, 7% poor, 19% fair, and 72% good to excellent. That's unchanged from a week ago. For soybeans, 60% of the crop is blooming. That's unchanged from last week, but less than the five-year average of 72%. 19% of the soybean crop is setting pods versus 18% last week and the five-year rolling average of 31%. Soybean conditions, 3% very poor, 7% poor, 23% fair, 67% good to excellent. That's unchanged from last week. Here are the ratings from some of the key states across the Corn Belt.
This is Greg Tayson, Director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending July 25, 2010. Another round of rainfall throughout the state left fields either heavily saturated or flooded. Many of the ponded areas that had begun to dry out last week began to grow again, leaving replanted crops standing in water. Crops on higher ground and sandy soil are in excellent condition, while crops on flatter and low-lying ground are in much worse shape. Considering all the excess rain during the week, no significant crop damage was reported. Topsoil and subsoil moisture are both rated 100% adequate to surplus across the state. Near normal July temperatures and humidity allowed crops to progress, with improvement in corn and soybean color reported in southwest Iowa. Statewide, 94% of the corn acres have tasseled, 85% have silked, and 21% have reached the milk stage, all three well ahead of last year and normal. Corn condition rated 70% good to excellent, up 1 point from last week. 82% of the soybean crop has bloomed, compared with 78% last year and 81% for the five-year average. Pods have set on 44% of the soybean acres, 3 days ahead of last year and 1 day ahead of normal. Soybean condition rated 71% good to excellent, also up 1 point from last week. Temperatures for the week averaged 1.4 days above normal, while the statewide average rainfall was 3.19 inches, compared with the normal of 0.94 inches. This was the eighth consecutive wetter-than-normal week and the third week this summer to average over 3 inches of rainfall. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Mark Schleusener with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending July 25th. High temperatures and drenching rains hit Illinois last week. Temperatures averaged 3.1 degrees above normal, and rainfall averaged 3.25 inches around the state. That's 2.23 inches above normal. Average growing degree days for the state reached 1,865, which is 9% above normal for this date. Crop progress for corn continues well ahead of the average pace. Corn in the dough stage and beyond reached 41% compared to 21% normally. 3% of corn acres have reached the dense stage. 65% of the crop was rated in good or excellent condition. For soybeans, crop progress continues to be slightly ahead of normal. 79% of the crop is blooming compared to 71% for the five-year average. 36% of the crop is setting pods compared to 29% normally. 63% of the crop was rated in good or excellent condition. Oat harvest reached 72% complete compared to 46% normally. This has been Mark Schleusener with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason in, well, still on vacation, but shortly to talk to Dan O'Brien today, and I'll be back tomorrow in full force here on IPM. Dan O'Brien, of course, an extension agricultural economist at K-State. And he has penned an article that takes a look at acreage for corn in the United States as ethanol use is ramped up from E10, E12 to E15, and accounts for the DDGs. Why don't you tell me a bit about that, and thanks for joining us today, Dan.
Yes, Todd, great to talk to you. In looking at how alternative scenarios might work out for corn usage, as we would move, again, towards from E10 current policy to an E12 or E15 policy, a person has to determine where the supplies will come from to feed or enable us to produce the higher amounts of ethanol that would be required under the E12 and E15 scenarios. And in doing that, you basically look at several possibilities of either cutting back usage for different categories or examining how much acreage of corn would need to increase to be able to continue to meet all the needs that are out there. If you take the more limited approach and figure that the amount of corn acreage that we'd have in the United States will match up with what the USDA has projected in their latest 10-year projection, then you end up, at least by my thoughts initially, it would seem that if you make the assumption that we'll fully supply our domestic industries first and then see any cutbacks probably on the export side while still not wanting or not allowing to see corn ending stocks go to zero but to maintain, say, at a billion bushels or so, if you make that assumption, then again, you're seeing a trade-off between increased ethanol production and decreased exports. And by the time you move up to from E12 to E15, you'll have had a dramatic effect, a better term, I guess, on the amount of corn that the U.S. would push into world export supply channels. And that would be that'd cause a major change in the world feed grain market, again, being that the U.S. right now supplies 50-60% or more of world corn exports. So that there would be sizable secondary and third step effects that would come in on the world stage if that happened.
So the first thing that maybe we ought to talk about is that you use DDGs here. You account for them, say they're all used in the same year because it is a product that does go out of condition fairly quickly, and that in the local supply that it is used on a one-for-one-pound basis, so that 1 pound of corn, 1 pound of DDGs, for disappearance, so we can account for that. And then if you hold everything else steady, you say that as we bump from E10 to E12 to E15, the export market will drop dramatically. And it goes from what, $2 billion to $342 million or something there?
Yeah, you're seeing export numbers in the United States for corn that would drop below a billion bushel for sure, and getting closer to 250 to 500 million in a lot of cases. So that's a challenging issue. Now, for sure, the positive side of that is that with increased ethanol production, you will have more DDGs available, and that will help to offset some of the other changes that you'd see in livestock feeding and on the export side. So that's an offsetting positive for sure.
Do you export the DDGs in your scenarios?
Yes, we show we're making an assumption that over time, as we increase ethanol and DDG production in the United States, that we're exporting about 20 to 21% of that each year. And that has been a good market, up to now, for U.S. DDGs. So we'd anticipate that would continue to go forth.
And then let's take the next step, because you hold things steady, but if that means everything kind of stays steady and usage stays the same, and you're using the USDA projected numbers. But you go to the next step and say, well, what if we move things around just a bit? What do you see at that point then?
Yes, and in essence, if we're unwilling to see that much of a drop off in world exports of corn, of U.S. exports of corn into world channels, and instead allow for or figure out how many more acres of corn we need to be able to supply all the domestic uses and the export uses, then you start seeing sizable increases in corn acres that would be needed. And again, going from E10 to E12, you'll see some increases of X amount of acres. For instance, you're looking at, say, in year 2012, 2013, under the current scenario of static acres, we'd see about 90 million acres up to 91 to 92 throughout the rest of the period. If you go to E12, you'd be looking at something like 95 to 97 million acres throughout the period. If you go to E15, you're looking at more like 102 to 103 million acres of corn being planted in the United States. So I guess on the positive side, if we allow corn acreage to increase, then you can meet all the supply demand needs for corn in the United States. But if you basically stay with the same type of or same range of acreage that we have had in the last 2 to 3 years, then you probably have to see some type of a paring down of use in some pretty important categories.
Mr. O'Brien, thanks for being with us.
Todd, thank you very much.
That's Dan O'Brien. He's with K-State Extension, joining us here on the Closing Market Report. Of course, I'll be back in this seat full-time tomorrow. My thanks to Dave Dickey for filling in for me while I've been on vacation.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's National Scotch Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1586, Sir Walter Raleigh brought the first tobacco to England from Virginia. In 1880, A.P. Aborn patented a method for refining coconut oil. In 1910, large hailstones fell in Todd and Wadena counties in Minnesota, some weighing as much as 5 pounds. In 1918, the first concrete barge was launched into Flushing Bay, New York. Its hull was made of steel-reinforced concrete, and it was designed to carry oil. The barge was 98 feet long, 31 feet wide, and 9.5 feet deep. In 1931, a swarm of grasshoppers destroyed thousands of acres of crops in Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. The cornfields were totally destroyed without a stalk left standing. Those who experienced it said that it was not an exaggeration to say that the grasshoppers were so thick that you could scoop them up in a shovel. Motor travelers had to roll up their windows to keep them from raining in on their feet. In 1931, Auguste Henri Fourel was born. The next time you are at a picnic and become overtaken by ants, think of him. He wrote a 5-volume work titled The Social World of the Ants. And in 1940, Bugs Bunny made his screen debut in A Wild Hare. And that's this day in agricultural history. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is Don Day of Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Good afternoon, Don.
Good afternoon.
Looks to me like we have a cool front passing our way.
We do, and this is going to trigger some shower and thunderstorm activity. The air behind the front, not terribly cold, and everything that we're seeing is a pattern that really, quite honestly, looks very favorable for continued good crop development. Temperatures are going to be averaging close to normal, maybe slightly above, and there continues to be enough weather systems coming through to occasionally bring shower and thunderstorm activity to the Corn Belt and the Midwest. Of course, you're always going to have maybe one or two areas that get a bit more rain than is needed. This will be especially true where it's been lately in some of the northwestern areas, portions of Iowa, portions of Minnesota. Could see some heavier thunderstorm activity with that cold front coming through today and tomorrow.
But nothing like what we saw earlier this week in the Chicago area.
It doesn't look like it. Anytime you get into this pattern of summertime thunderstorms, you're always going to have some thunderstorms get nasty. You're always going to have some flooding. But in terms of that happening on a widespread basis, no.
And then next week's weather will be warmer then and maybe not quite as much rain or what?
Well, I think that's probably a good way to describe it, a little bit warmer, but the rain chances aren't going to completely go away, although certainly it is going to be more moist here in the next 5 days as compared to next week's weather. But even then, I do see a few opportunities for some shower and thunderstorm activity to wander across the Midwest.
So nothing that will become critically dry over the next couple of weeks.
It certainly doesn't look that way. And temperatures, while we've got some warm, hot, muggy days coming, we don't see any record-breaking heat for the Corn Belt and Midwest, where we've had the heat waves along the East Coast and into some of the southern plains. Those areas are going to be a little bit hotter, but even the hot spots are going to see temperatures that are going to be a little bit more reasonable.
So spots like Kansas, some relief in sight.
Yeah, there's some relief, although if there's one part of the country that's still going to be suffering a bit from dryness and heat, Kansas, portions of Oklahoma, the Texas Panhandle.
Why are they experiencing this kind of weather pattern this year?
Well, a little bit of bad luck, really. And it's not a terribly large area, but the way the high-pressure systems have set up across the United States, at least so far this summer, the high-pressure system that usually does settle into the southern plain states has developed a little bit further to the west than it normally does. And that has shut off the moisture tap from the south and west, helping to bring thunderstorms to Kansas that we usually see this time of year. And that has been almost a semi-permanent situation for the last 3 or 4 weeks. But in this following week or two, that high is going to drift a little more east, and we're going to see the moisture flow get a little bit better into those states, Oklahoma and Kansas especially.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Don Day of Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And that is today's Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now for the rest of you and online at willag.org. Stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Mike Score. He's the president of Hance Farms in Detroit. Their job, as they see it, is to develop an urban farm in the scattered areas that have now been decimated in Detroit in terms of population. Mr. Score, thank you so much for being with us. Tell me a bit more about the project.
Sure. Hance Farms is a large for-profit farm in the city of Detroit. The founder is John Hance. John is a successful businessman from the financial services sector, and he would like to use his private equity to help Detroit become a more livable community by transforming vacant, blighted properties into a large-scale for-profit farm.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what has happened to Detroit. Over the past decade, there's been a mass exodus, and it's a lot of it has come recently, but there has been a mass exodus from that city, I think, of about, 1.2 million people. Is that correct?
Well, at a peak, the Detroit population was about 1.5 million, and currently people estimate the population to be about 800,000. So if you go from its high point to its current population, we've dropped quite a bit.
Oh, right. So I was thinking probably of Detroit and maybe some of the collar areas. Can you define what area you're looking at? I'm familiar with Detroit and what is commonly referred to, I think, in the media there, sort of an 8 mile road or radius around the center part of Detroit where there's a lot of population that has exited. Is that correct?
There are pockets of prosperity in Detroit, and there are pockets of areas where people have left, and we need a new land use plan for a viable, livable community. If you go to the east side of Detroit, and if you look at a map, Woodward Avenue is locally considered to be the divider between east and west. We're looking at properties that are east of Woodward and south of Interstate 94. So the lower east side of Detroit is where we're looking to start our farm.
And when you go to do that, what's the first step?
Well, there are a lot of first steps, but we had to have a business plan to make sure that the project was even feasible. So that took quite a bit of time. There's a lot of research involved, market research, identifying target customers, making sure that the land was there to be aggregated. But once we had a business plan, then we had to approach local government and negotiate with them, communicate with them, and help them to see how this farm fits into a better Detroit. And once that understanding is achieved, then now we are going to the final stages of acquiring real estate. So we have to purchase a lot of land from local government, but then there are some privately held parcels as well. And we believe that we'll be finishing up our first phase acquisition in June or July of 2010. Then we have to do environmental assessments. We have to order our production inputs. And this fall, we should begin site preparation and putting our first crops in the ground.
Tell me about the vision you have for this urban farm and the size, scale, the crops that might be there, what kinds of cleanup work you have to do to get it started.
Okay. There are three levels of success for the farm. The first is simply a production operation. So just like farms out in the countryside, we'll establish a production operation, and our goal is to be profitable. The second level of success has to do with education and tourism. If we were out in the more remote areas of the state, we probably wouldn't have much of an emphasis on those enterprises, but being in the city brings a lot of advantages, not only from an education perspective, but from a revenue-generating perspective. So our second level of success will be to have the public begin using our farm as a gathering place, to learn about our food system, to enjoy Michigan agriculture, to see the diversity of Michigan agriculture, and to bring out-of-town guests when they come to Detroit. The third level of success is, I think, the most ambitious level, and this is the level that we're striving for with John Hansen, the employees of the Hans Group. we would like to become the global center for innovation in urban agriculture. There are several significant efforts around the world to explore integration of agriculture into urban centers so that the food needs of an global population. The world population is projected to be 9 billion by the year 2050, and there's a group of people who believe that conventional agriculture will contribute to that challenge, but will not meet the challenge of feeding 9 billion people. So we'll have to find ways to integrate agriculture back into urban centers. And in a northern climate like Michigan, urban agriculture includes enterprises like indoor production of fruits and vegetables year-round in controlled climates. So we would like to assemble some of the most innovative urban agriculture production systems in the world in one place, and then have leaders from around the world come to Detroit to see what's possible in the emerging urban agricultural industry.
Tell me about the properties that you're purchasing, both privately and from city governments at this time.
These properties are they're mixed. Some are industrial, some are former residential areas, and they vary in size. There are some parcels as large as 40 to 100, 200 acres. And then there are other sites that are smaller, probably 2 to 5 acres. So when we purchase land in a 300-acre area, we can probably initially own about 100 to 150 acres. And then over time, as other properties become foreclosed, we would purchase those as well. As we go forward, the farm will become more consolidated, but originally it'll be a bit scattered. In terms of soil quality, the soils are mixed. In a former residential area, there are a lot of basements that were filled in with fill material, and so you can get a variety of soil textures and soil fertility levels. A lot of people are wondering about soil contamination. We've already pulled 58 soil samples on sites that we're interested in purchasing, and we've yet to find a site that is above EPA thresholds for food production. So the soils that we've looked at so far have been clean, but we know eventually we'll find contaminated soils. A great part of Michigan agriculture is it's so diverse that even in uncontaminated soils, we can shift to crops like forestry or ornamental plants and still have those sites work in our business plan.
Yeah, so some of these sites, and you've talked about a couple of things that'd be in greenhouse production, I suppose, of some sort, or hydroponics possibly, but will much of it be outdoor agriculture, open land, and you'll
most
have
of most of our production will be outdoors. We'll use aeroponic systems indoors with LED lighting, so those actually won't be greenhouse systems. Even our hydroponic systems would probably use artificial light. But in our first phase of land acquisition, we expect to purchase somewhere around 100 to 150 acres. In 2010, and almost all of that will be outdoor production. Well, our first phase of production, we want to have a U-pick apple orchard and a U-cut Christmas tree operation, so those are outdoor crops. And then we'll have a significant forestry enterprise. That's a very long crop life cycle, and with some intermediate income coming from thinning of the trees and sale of firewood. Most of the land that we purchase will be used for outdoor production.
Both of those crops are long-term crops, and Christmas trees would take at least 5 years before you would get a return on them. Orchards, I think, about the same time before they start to produce. I don't recall how long it takes to get an orchard into production. But it sounds like a very long, labor-intensive process to begin with. And that you don't get returns right away, so Hans apparently is in for the long run at this time. What's the cleanup like on this site? I could only imagine that there's cement and lead-based paints and, well, houses and all the things that come with just natural city living.
Well, if you go to Detroit, you'll be surprised how much land's already vacant. The structures, in many cases, have been taken down. So we're down to bare ground, at least when you look across the surface. There's buried debris. It's one of the reasons that we're interested in forestry, orchards, Christmas trees, because other crops don't require extensive tillage, and if we can get the trees in the ground, they'll grow their way around the buried rubble. Cleanup in terms of heavy metals like lead will depend on soil contamination levels. And again, the initial soil testing, we've been fortunate to find that soils that we're interested in buying, at least at this point, are not contaminated.
Tell me about Mr. Hantz and why he's interested in doing this. It seems for a man in a company that is a financial company, it seems a lot more altruistic than what he's done in the past. But I don't know him, nor have I read very much about him. So maybe you can give me an idea of the people behind this project.
It's a combination of being a good neighbor and launching out into a new and exciting business venture. John has lived in the city of Detroit for over 20 years, and unlike other wealthy people, he made his money and then he stayed. And he's very fond of the city. He used to drive from his house in Southeast Michigan to his office in Southfield. And every day he'd drive through blighted areas and hope that they would someday improve. And over the years, he noticed they weren't improving, they were getting bigger. And he got to the point where he was asking when the city would get around to fixing this problem. And a couple years ago, he realized that the city can't. The city has a structural budget deficit, declining population, increased cost of urban services. So then he wondered what the business community might do, and more specifically what he might do. And he realized that while he can't solve the whole problem, Detroit has 40 square miles of vacant tax-reverted properties, he could do something. And so he made a personal choice to commit $30 million of his private equity to launch a farm in the city to transform blighted vacant areas into places of beauty and more livable communities. But he wanted to do this in a way that would carry itself forward. He didn't want it to be a drain on local governments or on his company. So he decided to approach the farm as a for-profit venture. John is very innovative. He's a visionary. The other day I was talking to someone and I said, John's unusual. We see the color spectrum, Roy G. Biv. For John, the V stands for value. And he sees all the other colors that we see, but he can look at a distressed part of the economy, and from with his experience and his innovation, he can see value where others only see chronic problems. And it's just thrilling to work with John.
Today we're talking with Mike Skor. He's the president of Hantz Farms in Detroit. More with him when we return here on The Farming World.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, a draft bill from the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee would lower the ethanol tax credit to 36 cents a gallon, a 20% cut. For biofuels, the draft would also extend the 54 cent a gallon tariff on imported ethanol for 1 year through 2011. It would reinstate the biodiesel and renewable biodiesel tax credit for 2011, and it would allow producers to claim an investment tax in lieu of the $1 a gallon cellulosic biofuels producer credit. The Commerce Department today says that sales of new U.S. single-family homes rebounded sharply in June from the prior month's record low, pushing the number of houses on the market to the lowest level in nearly 42 years. New home sales vaulted 23.6% to a 330,000-unit annual rate. The percentage increase last month was the largest since May of 1980. Chemical maker DuPont Company today says its net income nearly tripled in the second quarter as sales surged in most of its businesses. DuPont's net income rose to $1.16 billion, or $1.26 per share, from $417 million, or $0.46 per share. DuPont said agriculture and nutrition revenue rose 16% to $3 billion. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to The Farming World. It's news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Mike Score. He's the president of Hance Farms out of Detroit. They're hoping to develop an urban farm. You told us that you expect to have the initial purchases done in June or July of this year, Mr. Score. I think of maybe 150 to 300 acres, but you're hoping to have a much larger farm over time. How big would you think this might grow to be?
Well, we're committed to right-sizing our farm to our marketplace. So in the first phase, we're modestly sized, 100 to 300 acres. And when the farm is up and running, there are some proof of concept projects that we have to complete so that city leaders become comfortable with the feasibility of a for-profit farm in the city. If the city buys in, if they become all in on this project, there are a lot of neighborhoods in the city that could benefit from a large-scale farm. And as long as we can expand production in a way that moves product into the marketplace with a profit margin and the city has an appetite for a bigger farm, we'll continue to expand. So we're not afraid to stop at 100 acres, but we're not afraid to go to 10,000 acres. And we'll right-size ourselves based on market response.
You are the new president of Hance Farms, but you came from MSU. Can you tell me about your work there?
I graduated from MSU in 1980 and hired into MSU as an agricultural agent back then. In between then and now, I worked with the Mennonite Church in Africa. I worked with University of Kentucky and Southeast Kentucky, and then moved back to the region 13 years ago as an agricultural agent near Ann Arbor, Michigan. 7 years ago, I switched the focus of my work to work with Chris Peterson at the Product Center of MSU, and I helped people write business plans for food and agricultural ventures. And really working with Michigan agriculture to convert our relatively low-priced commodities into higher-value consumer goods. MSU is a real strong partner in Hance Farms. Our farm, in effect, will serve as an urban agricultural research station for MSU. We'll have students involved through internships at the farm at all levels of the operation, and we will partner with MSU to find interesting, exciting research initiatives that will make it easier to expand urban agriculture to a global level.
Can you tell me about the business plan that you presented to the Detroit City Council and what it said about who the target consumer might be for the products that you expect to raise?
Sure. Because our business plan includes a for-profit farm as a farm, but then also education and tourism enterprises, we're projecting a mix of wholesale and retail accounts. So on a conservative level, we're projecting 70 to 80% of our total production going into the market through wholesale buyers or large institutional buyers, and the balance being sold direct retail to people who come visit our farm. In reality, we think that we'll have a higher percentage going direct retail, but in the budgeting world, we like to be conservative. It's interesting. We've had major corporations with national chains come to us, and we have five or six national retailers who said individually that they would like to buy everything that we're going to produce. They're very excited about urban agriculture, using agriculture as a tool for revitalizing a city like Detroit. There's been a lot of media attention to Hans Farms. People in general just really like the idea. So we don't have any anxieties about being able to sell into wholesale markets. There's already a lot of competition, and we haven't really begun production yet.
What do you expect transportation problems will be like for you? You are in the midst, while it's a blighted area, you will be right in the middle of a city.
Yeah, it's going to be great to be in the middle of a city. The way our farm is laid out, we'll be working with smaller fields. And, for example, our orchard will be U-Pick. So we're not going to have to haul our apples to some destination. We expect most of our apples to be sold directly to consumers. Our land is not far from Eastern Market, so it's only a matter of a few miles to get from most of our production centers to Detroit's Eastern Market. And there's a terminal market at Eastern Market where our wholesalers can pick up their products. So transportation actually works quite well for us in Detroit.
If it all works exactly the way you want it to, what do you think Hans Farms will look like in 10 years?
Hans Farms will be the place to go in the Midwest because we have a collection of before pictures, and then Hans Farms will be a place of beauty. We have a large budget for landscaping the property to make it a real show place. We'll have innovative production systems, and those production systems will be changing as new technologies come forward. So it'll be, we like to say it's like the auto show, but for urban agriculture. So there'll be some enterprises that'll be proven concepts, and you can go and you can look at those because, you know, you're thinking about buying them. But you can also go and see prototypes of new systems, new production systems for urban agriculture, and you can imagine what's possible at Hans Farms. So that's what we envision. It'll in our region, we have the Detroit Zoo, we have Greenfield Village as major tourism destinations, and Hans Farms will be a new destination in that constellation of places to go.
That's Mike Score. He is the president of Hans Farms. You've been listening to him on The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.